really looking forward to this first half hour of the program today because one of the people in the 20th century I most greatly admire, and really for a single reason. There are other reasons, of course, that would go along with it, but really my admiration stems from one reason, is C.S. Lewis. Now, his fiction has been made so very popular in the last several weeks by the release of the movie based upon one of the novels of the Chronicles of Narnia series. And that is great stuff. There's no doubt about it. But if you read Lewis, and that's really a task in and of itself, you discover that you are dealing with, you are engaging one of the brightest minds in the 20th century, perhaps in other centuries as well. We're going to be talking about C.S. Lewis on education here in the first part of a ongoing series on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Irrigating Desert, C.S. Lewis on Education. Dr. Joel Heckel joins us here in just a moment. You can join us as well, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Coming up in 25 minutes, Wesley Smith, good friend, joins us to talk about two issues. First of all, the unthinkable. Of course, the unthinkable very quickly becomes the thinkable. I don't think that's Lewis. I think that's Chesterton. The use of embryonic stem cells on dying people, not to save their lives, but just to test what will happen. We'll also talk about the stem cell debacle in South Korea and why one of the most prestigious peer-reviewed journals of science published the work of this South Korean scientist, and it turns out to be bogus. Then, a little later in that hour, we're going to play the NBC piece from recently on the history of the Supreme Court and abortion, a surprising thumbnail sketch of what's been going on during nomination processes in the past. And then we'll also hear a little bit of O'Reilly and Letterman. That's from last week. Bill O'Reilly was a guest on David Letterman's The Late Show. Is that what they call it? Yeah. And they had a very spirited conversation. It's a good example of a contrast between objective and subjective. And speaking of that, a little later in the program, there in the second hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Bart Ehrman on the reliability of the New Testament. He has written a book called Misquoting Jesus, the story behind who changed the Bible and why. And the issue of subjective versus objective will play into that conversation as well. We're going to be talking with Dr. Gene Smith, beginning a six-part series on Eastern Orthodoxy later in the program as well. And as far as I know, that's all we're doing. Oh, by the way, after we play that Ehrman interview where he wants to call into question virtually all of the New Testament, we're going to be looking for your phone calls at 5 o'clock. Again, our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Joel Heck is Vice President of Academic Services for Concordia University in Austin, Texas, and he's author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. Dr. Heck, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's good to be on with you.
Well, before we get started, I'm about to head down to my hometown, Dallas, Texas. Quite a distance from Austin. What's the weather like in Texas?
It's about 63 degrees. We're facing a cold snap. It's been 70s and late 80s for the last couple of weeks, so it's been beautiful.
What's a cold snap in Austin?
Well, at this time of year, it's really 30s and can get into the 20s for a low temperature, but it's all relative.
Oh, yes.
As you know.
It is all relative. Well, first question, what did C.S. Lewis, what did he mean when he said that the task of modern education is not so much clearing jungle but irrigating deserts?
Well, I think he meant that education is a positive venture rather than a negative venture. And when he said that, I think he was very much aware of a Cambridge University English professor by the name of Leavis, F.R. Leavis, who was well known in England at the time. And Leavis took a look at literature and various authors and would explain why he didn't think those authors were worth reading. And it seemed, he was an editor of a magazine called Scrutiny. And a guy by the name of Donald Davy once remarked that the charm of Scrutiny lay in the fact that with each issue, the reader was provided with a dozen authors or books or whole periods and genres of literature, which I not only need not, but should not read. So the more you read Leavis, the more you realized you didn't have to read literature. And so Leavis had all kinds of reasons why various people, other than about five or six prose writers and five or six poets, should be read. So I liken it to caring for a lawn. If you want a great lawn, the best thing you can do is to fertilize the grass to enable it to grow strong rather than spending all your time pulling up weeds. So education is a very positive thing. The teacher, the professor, the instructor needs to present content to students, needs to engage students in learning of the material in that subject area as they get acquainted with life and life issues.
The more one looks into Lewis, the more one is both awed and a little bit intimidated. Talk about his mind, and if you would, a story or two about Lewis's famed Total Recall.
Okay, well, one of my favorite stories comes from December 3rd, 1954. Lewis had spent 29 years at Oxford University and would spend the rest of his career at Cambridge while still living in Oxford. And December 3rd, 1954 was the last day that Lewis gave tutorials. And so that evening, the English faculty decided to have a dinner in his honor, and they invited a few students from the undergraduate program, a couple of Rhodes Scholars, students from a literary society called the Florio Society. And so in the dinner that evening, the conversation got around to writing and, well, what was Lewis working on these days? And Lewis said he wasn't writing much of anything because all of his paragraphs tended to end up in iambic pentameter. Well, a young man by the name of Richard Selig, a Rhodes Scholar, said, well, if you choose to end your paragraphs in iambic pentameter, what is that to us? In other words, why don't you just stop ending your sentences in iambic pentameter? And Lewis turned to him and he said, well, as usual, Selig, you misunderstand. He said, I remember everything that I've ever read and bits of it pop up uninvited. And that's what was happening. A lot of that poetic meter was popping into Lewis's head as he was writing, and he didn't have a lot of control over it. And Selig was flabbergasted, and he said, well, surely not everything you've ever read. And Lewis said, yes, everything. So Selig says, well, what about Lydgate's poem called The Siege of Thebes? And that's a very obscure 16th century poem, but Lewis would have read it at some point because he wrote a magisterial work that was published in 1954 called The English Literature in the 16th Century, Excluding Drama. And so Lewis said, well, you have to start me. So Selig had to go and get a book that contained that poem in it, and he came back sometime later, started reading the poem, and Lewis shouted, stop, and lifted his eyes to the ceiling and picked up quoting the poem where Selig left off. I think that story illustrates Lewis's powerful memory, not always total recall and pure rote memorization. He understood things in context, and very often it was said that given any line of Paradise Lost, he could quote the next line. And so sometimes you had to get him started, but once he got started, his memory was phenomenal.
You also note that others have seen Lewis, in terms of his mind as a polymath, he was both deep and broad.
Yes. He was able to do what I wish every student of the liberal arts was able to do. He was able to take his training in Greek and Latin texts, which is called Honor Moderations at Oxford when he was an undergraduate, and then his training in philosophy and ancient history, which completed his bachelor's degree, and then his second degree in English language and literature, and pull things together from literature that illustrated history, things from philosophy that helped him understand his theology, and pull all of these things together and draw on those various strands of knowledge for whatever he was writing or teaching at the time. And he had a tremendous ability to quote masses of material from authors he really liked and from some that he didn't like.
You write, Lewis tells us that the fundamental problem in education is not our wrong thinking, but our lack of thinking. What do you mean by that?
Yes, well, that's the irrigating deserts concept again, that too often students come into a classroom, and I'm talking now as a professor, students come into a classroom and they are relatively passive learners, and the best kind of learning that takes place when a student is engaged in learning, when a student takes ownership in the learning, not only in laying out their academic program, but going into a course not to do the minimum necessary to get by and get the grade they want, or not. One of my pet peeves, one of the phrases that I do not like to hear anyone say, student or faculty, is, well, I need to get this out of the way. There is no course in our curriculum here, and I suspect anywhere in the Concordia University system, that is required so that students can get it out of the way. But they need to come in and engage in the learning process and have their minds filled with all kinds of wonderful ideas from that particular subject matter, and enable them then not only to receive that matter, but then to analyze it, to break it apart, pull it back together, to connect it to other fields of learning like Lewis did so well, to be a critical thinker and to be able to judge what is true and what is false in some piece of literature, for instance, that you're writing. And I think that's what Lewis was talking about.
What was education like at his time, and what kind of a critique did Lewis offer against education at his time, things that he thought could be improved?
Well, there are a lot of different things he was concerned about. One was attending school or taking a course of study for vocational or utilitarian purposes. I know public education these days is talking a lot about workforce training, but that, I think, best left for the technical schools. He wanted people to be well-grounded in the liberal arts, and so he resisted the idea that you need to have some sort of practical purpose in mind for taking any given course. He wanted students to get engaged in understanding a slice of reality in a good deal of depth and quite a bit of breadth. So utilitarianism and vocationalism, that are kind of cousins, those are some things that he had real problems with and fought against.
We're talking about C.S. Lewis and education. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. He is author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Irrigating Desert, C.S. Lewis on Education. Our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. At 4:30, we're going to be talking, I'm sorry, at 3:30, we're going to be talking with Wesley Smith about two issues, both the debacle in South Korea on stem cell research and human cloning, also a doctor who would like to use embryonic stem cells on dying people, not to cure them, but to see what will happen when he experiments on them. Wesley Smith will be our guest in about 20 minutes here on Issues Etc. Dr. Heck, you mentioned the liberal arts. Give us a brief definition of that, and why was Lewis so earnest that this be the course, especially of higher education?
Well, the liberal arts really goes back to the medieval time period, and the medieval trivium was the foundation of the liberal arts, which is basically grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And those are subject areas that not only teach a given subject, but also help somebody learn how to think. For the medieval mind, and even to a certain extent today, grammar was not just English grammar or the grammar of a particular language, but it was the building blocks of any given subject. So the hard data, the facts, figures, dates, places, and so on, and names. Then logic is how all of that fits together into an orderly progression, something that an area of study like philosophy would help one to do. And then rhetoric, it has to do with how you present that, how you communicate that information, the grammar as it is organized logically. And so those three, the medieval trivium, are really the foundation of the liberal arts. And there were four additional courses that were built upon that, but the trivium served as the bachelor's degree back in the medieval period, and the so-called quadrivium formed the subject matter for learning and earning the master's degree. And so the liberal arts are In America in particular, most institutions work with what we call a distributed core and take courses, one, two, three, four courses, usually at most four, and require all students to learn these courses in the humanities, in math and science, in the fine arts, in our case, in theology, and in English and communication, and learn those basic subject areas and be able to bring them together and bring them to bear on a particular course of study in a major and perhaps also a minor. And these subject areas are the kinds of courses that prepare one for life, not just for a particular vocation. So I believe that if a student applies him or herself well to the liberal arts curriculum, and they end up not getting a job in the area of their major, they will still be able to function well. And in fact, 80% of our society, people are working in an area that they didn't study, that was not their area of major study in college. And so the liberal arts is in a sense, a solution to the problem of job mobility, because it enables a person who can think well, who can communicate well, who understands the foundations of Western civilization, can do some problem solving, and can think theologically, that person has a strong opportunity to serve in a wide variety of fields rather than the single specific field for which he or she is trained.
You mentioned theology as part of a liberal arts education in our case. What role would have theology held for Lewis in terms of his view of education? Did he see it as something that every well-rounded student ought to pursue? Would he have put it alongside literature and the other things that he loves so dearly?
He did list theology as one of the areas of the curriculum that people should study. But the Oxford curriculum, when he was an undergraduate, as well as when he was a professor, didn't allow for the study of the liberal arts in quite the same way that we do it in our so-called distributed core. When you attend Oxford University, you enter a 3 or 4 year course of study in one particular discipline, and that's it. So rather than a wide variety of disciplines in a liberal arts core, and then a major built on top of that, his first 2 years were studying simply Greek and Latin as an undergraduate, and his next 2 years were studying philosophy and history, just those two areas to earn his bachelor's degree. And then when he went for his second degree, the only area that he studied was English language and literature. So there was a lot of depth and breadth within that field, but typically, even though familiarity with Scripture was part of the expectation for a student when Lewis went to college, that has changed significantly since his day.
So Scripture would have been, in that context, considered part of the body of classics, that original sources that Lewis would have advocated for students to know.
There would have been some biblical literature that would have been studied. I think they would have separated out the classics from, say, New Testament Greek and the New Testament in English language.
What role did did objective truth play in Lewis's ideas about education?
Lewis often talked about the Tao, spelled T-A-O, a Chinese concept from the Taoist religion that basically is shorthand in Lewis's thinking for an objective standard of right and wrong. He really believed in objective truth. He would have no appreciation for reader response theory, for instance, today in the field of English studies, where the text only becomes what the reader makes it, and there is no objective meaning to a text of even Scripture or English literature. He would totally reject that. So, yeah, he believed in objective truth, and he thought it was important to know what the author intended to convey, and he applied that both in his area of study, especially English, but also in his study of Scripture. And probably his book, Mere Christianity, is the best place to take a look at what Lewis had to say about the Tao or natural law or that objective standard of right and wrong. And as a Christian, he believed that the Bible contained that as well, and so provided a sure guide for any individual who wanted to know what parts of reality do you believe and what parts do you not. Do you buy into the myth, for instance, that people are born good or born neutral, or do you understand from Scripture that we're born sinful human beings?
What was the, if you can be summarized with one purpose, what was the purpose of education for Lewis?
To produce the good citizen, a person who's a contributing member of that country, that state. He was following Milton and Aristotle in that. So, the task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. That's what I, as a professor of Old Testament here at Concordia, need to be doing. But my purpose is not to irrigate deserts. My purpose, what I want to see happen as an outcome for my students, is to produce the good citizen who will be, for instance, an altruistic person, thinking of other people first rather than themselves. And, of course, that happens best, I think, when it is paired with the study of Scripture.
Did Lewis see learning, the task of learning, ongoing discovery, as a self-evident good, as a good in and of itself?
Yes, I think so. You don't have to be able to measure it in order to be able to prove that. But he saw it as a self-evident good, and not necessarily something good in and of itself, rather than something that can produce a particular aim that you're hoping for. For instance, a lot of young people go to college today because they want to get a good-paying job and make lots of money. And they've heard the rubric that the typical college graduate earns about $1,000 a month more than someone who doesn't go to college. And they see the dollar signs, and they realize college is expensive, but over a 40-year career, I'm going to come out way ahead. And they go to college with the idea of making a name for themselves, making money. And Lewis says, you got it backwards.
Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January, is called Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. Its author, our guest in this half hour, Dr. Joel Heck. It's $22.99 plus shipping and handling, and you can browse before you buy by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. You'll find the book there, or you can call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and order the book, Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. Dr. Joel Heck is Vice President of Academic Services at Concordia University in Austin, Texas, and author of this book, Irrigating Deserts. Thanks for being our guest.
You're very welcome.
When we come back from this break, Wesley Smith joins us to talk about the stem cell debacle in South Korea and embryonic stem cell research.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The many writings of C.S. Lewis deliver to us the mind of perhaps one of the greatest popular thinkers of the 20th century. That raises a natural question. What kind of an education did C.S. Lewis receive? What kind of an educator was Lewis? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January is called Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. The book is $22.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House. Call them any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January, Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy. Just go to our website and find the book on our homepage, issuesetc.org. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January, C.S. Lewis on Education. It's called Irrigating Deserts.
Share Christ with a diverse group of people, university students, and abandoned women and children. This Global Minute lets you know you have the chance to reach places where no one knows Christ. Asia Challenge Teams, a ministry of Operation Mobilization, is a powerful way to learn about spiritual needs across Asia. If you care about Buddhists or Muslims, you can get a thorough overview of their culture and beliefs. The mission agency Operation Mobilization places you on a team for 1 to 2 years in different places doing various ministries. You'll learn how to explain the great spiritual needs across Asia to friends. They can commit to prayer for this vast continent where only a tiny percentage of people actually follow Christ. Pray for more Christians to effectively share Christ's love across Asia. Open your eyes to mission opportunities through OM's website, www.om.usa.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. If the ghosts of the Founding Fathers are hovering over the Senate hearings for Judge Alito, I don't believe they are, but if they were, they would be pleased. The process they set down in the Constitution is working. We watch the hearings on C-SPAN and catch snippets in news broadcasts, and we see the clash of conflicting ideologies. So the Founders intended it. According to Akhil Amar, Article 3 of the Constitution provided for an openly political and ideological process of initial appointment. Presidents and senators could not properly extract promises from a judicial nominee, but were free to indulge in predictions about how that nominee might rule, and to factor such predictions into their appointment calculus. Throughout history, judicial appointments and confirmation have often been ideological, often along party lines. So, Abraham Lincoln in 1863 appointed a Union, not a secessionist judge, to the Supreme Court. In that appointment was an even deeper ideological divide, the abolition of slavery. For many of us, the pro-life ideology is driven by God's commands to protect others, especially the weak and helpless. No, the ghosts of the Founders are not hovering, but the millions killed through abortion should haunt the Senate hearings. In 1864, Lincoln said, "If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong." Substitute abortion.
Mornings on AM 850 KFUO offer you a Christian way to start your weekday. Hi, I'm Paul Clayton, inviting you to hear your inspirational Christian favorites, great guests, and the information you need to prepare you for the road ahead. And after the morning show at 9:30, stick around for Focus on the Family on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Well, for this half hour, we're going to be spending some time with our good friend Wesley Smith from the Discovery Institute. Two things I've been anxious to talk about, and finally we get our opportunity with Wesley to talk about both the stem cell debacle in South Korea. Amazing it is to me that one of the most prestigious peer-reviewed scientific journals in the world publishes some research, or at least the findings of some research that turn out to be almost entirely bogus. How does that happen? Wesley will answer that question. We'll also talk with him a little bit about embryonic stem cells and dying people. There is a researcher who would like to use embryonic stem cells on terminal patients, not to seek a cure, but simply to see what happens. They used to call that using a human being as a guinea pig. Wesley will comment on that as well. Then coming up at 3:50, we're going to hear a piece from NBC News. Brian Williams, I believe, walking us through a brief history of the Supreme Court and the abortion issue, especially the nominees of about the last 30, 40 years, what they said during their confirmation hearings, how they finally ruled. It's very surprising stuff. At 4 o'clock, we're going to hear O'Reilly and David Letterman go toe-to-toe. It was a friendly but sometimes sharp-edged conversation last week on the Letterman Show. Between these two, it's a good illustration of objective versus subjective. We'll open the phone lines to get your reaction to it as well until 4:30. At 4:30, we're going to pick up a conversation with Dr. Bart Ehrman on the reliability of the New Testament. He's written a book called Misquoting Jesus, the story behind who changed the Bible and why. I want to hear from you after that as well. Our call-in number is 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. You're going to want to listen carefully to that 4:30 conversation with Dr. Ehrman. An honest man who is very willing to say what it is he doesn't believe and give reasons why, and essentially sees the New Testament as, well, I think it's fair to say almost entirely unreliable, and those parts that are reliable, we don't really know about those either. He's got this book called Misquoting Jesus, and you can call afterwards 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Gene Smith will join us for the last half hour of the program at 5:30 until 6. We're going to begin a six-part series with him on Eastern Orthodoxy. He is also writing an article, has written an article that's going to come out here in just a few weeks in our latest Issues Etc. journal, our Wittenberg Trail feature, talking about From Bondage to Freedom in Christ. Dr. Gene Smith will be our guest in the last half hour of Issues Etc. Wesley Smith is a regular guest. He's senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, a special consultant to the Center for Bioethics and Culture, and author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, it sounds like this is a Smith show today.
Yes, it is. Lots of Smiths. Lots of Smiths. And an occasional Ehrman in there as well. First of all, thank you very much. You are doing yeoman's work for us, lining up some very great guests for a hoped-for remote out there in the San Francisco area, live show from the Bay Area in California on February the 19th, around that time. And I just have to thank you for bringing in the kind of guests you're going to bring in for us.
Well, you're very welcome.
Wesley, how is it that one of the most prestigious peer-reviewed scientific journals in the world publishes research on human cloning and embryonic stem cell research that turns out, from South Korea, to be almost entirely bogus?
In fact, the cloning research was entirely bogus. Snuppy the dog, which is published in Nature, apparently was not bogus. Apparently, Snuppy is cloned. That's, I think, one of the big questions that is not being asked very vibrantly among the mainstream media today. I mean, you see stories reporting that this was a fraud, that Woo-Suk Hwang has not indeed created cloned human embryonic stem cell lines. He has not created patient-specific stem cell lines. He has manipulated and falsified the science. And that is an important question because I think it calls into question the whole concept of peer review. And I think in this particular case, because Hwang's supposed breakthrough was a huge political event in the stem cell debates, cloning debates here in this country. As soon as these articles were published, we started hearing a great deal of moaning and carrying on and caterwauling that George Bush's funding policy for embryonic stem cell research was allowing the United States to fall behind South Korean science, and we were losing our scientific edge. And now what's funny, Todd, is now that all of this is a fraud, some of the same voices are saying George Bush's funding policy created too much competition so that people were cutting corners. I mean, no matter what George Bush does, it's wrong in the minds of some people.
I just don't see the dots connected there, since it was not any of our federal money that went to fund Woo-Suk Hwang.
Well, they're saying that the fact that we didn't federally funded meant that the people who moved ahead had less good ethics than we would have done it, and a go-slow approach and an ethical approach had we funded therapeutic cloning research. But those very same people who said we would have done a go-slow ethical approach were mad because we were supposedly behind South Korea. So that just doesn't fly. But, you know, the question has to be asked about peer review, and peer review couldn't be more important because we not only does science, you know, if an army moves forward on its belly, right, science moves forward on these peer review journal articles that tell various scientists what's happening in various fields. And there are something like, I heard the other day, 50,000 articles now, different journals. And that means, it seems to me, that if something of this incredible audacity could actually fly for as long as it did, and if, in fact, it was actually broken by young Korean scientists who would seem have less experience than the more seasoned scientists who supposedly peer-reviewed this for Science, the journal Science. And indeed, if it's true that Science, again, the peer-reviewed journal Science, actually cut in half the usual time for peer review, as was reported in the Wall Street Journal, in something that was this momentous, then perhaps politics got into science, which we've been seeing a lot of lately, and politics corrupts science. And so that's just one of the many questions that I think is raised by this terrible debacle. Another question is, when is the mainstream media going to even begin to show a little skepticism about the incredible hype and claims of those purporting to support therapeutic cloning and embryonic stem cell research? You don't see any skepticism. Even now, with this fraud being exposed, the party line is being held to. If you read today's New York Times and read Washington Post, again, remember we've talked about how they do a better job in the Post. That's an exception, the Rick Weiss article today. But the AP story, it's always, well, this isn't really that big a deal. Yes, it's a terrible fraud, but we can go forward. It's already been done in mice, and no skepticism. And here's one from the LA Times that really got to me. It was a good story because it reported how Wusak Wang came across a 12-year-old boy in a hospital who was paralyzed by a spinal cord injury. And the little boy said, "Will you make it so I can walk again?" Knowing that he was a fraud, knowing that he had not accomplished what he claimed, Wusak Wang told that little boy, "I promise," which is a despicable act. Now, the LA Times goes on to report, you know, this is a very big disappointment for that little boy, which of course it would be. But you know what could have come next and should have come next? All hope is not lost for this little boy. Indeed, in South Korea, a patient who'd been paralyzed with spinal cord injury for more than 19 years has had some, and this is in a peer-reviewed journal article, has had some movement and mobility restored through umbilical cord blood stem cells. That woman has appeared on television, standing up with the aid of a walker and so forth. In mice, paralyzed mice, have had mobility restored using olfactory stem cells, that is from the nasal mucosa, nose. These experiments have been conducted on at least 36 patients in Lisbon, Portugal, by Dr. Carlos Lima. And there has been testimony in the United States Senate at a committee meeting that this experimental treatment restored feeling and bladder control to quadriplegics. That should have been reported. And of course it wasn't, because even in the midst of this debacle, even as many of these newspaper articles are saying, oh, this is a setback for suffering people, they refuse to report the many breakthroughs that are happening and the great deal of optimism we should have for the future of regenerative medicine through these non-morally contentious sources of stem cells.
Wesley, the newly appointed director of Edinburgh University Center for Regenerative Medicine, Ian Wilmot, famous, of course, for Dolly the Sheep, has a new idea. What is it?
This is particularly disturbing because Ian Wilmot wants to short-circuit the usual ethical requirements for animal testing and so forth that you need to do before you begin human subject testing, and just go start testing embryonic stem cell research on people who are dying of Lou Gehrig's disease or have Lou Gehrig's disease and other neurological diseases. Now, this would seem to violate the Nuremberg Code, because before you can begin human subject testing, and by the way, if you're a patient and you take a risky medical procedure that's been tested and is now acceptable, that is something doctors are doing for you, even though it may have great risk. But if you are a research subject, that means doctors and scientists are doing things to you for the good of science. They may want to help you with that. That would be called a therapeutic test. But it is something that, by definition, hasn't yet been tested and is not yet approved for medical treatment. That being said, that doesn't mean you, because somebody is dying, you can come up with an idea for a treatment and then go right to treating that person. You have to have gone through sufficient testing in animal models and other testing to show both efficacy and relative safety.
Wesley,
embryonic stem cells don't meet that requirement either for efficacy for treating Lou Gehrig's disease or safety because they cause brain tumors.
So that was my question. Is there any reason to believe that embryonic stem cells are safe to try on humans for anything?
Not yet. As far as I can tell, there are two major issues if it's not cloned. One is the tumor issue. We know they cause terrible teratomas, which are a collection of different kinds. They can't control the proliferation of these cells. So these are tumors made up of very different kinds of tissues. And secondly, if it's a embryonic stem cell line that is not cloned from the patient, it would likely be rejected by the body in the same way the body would reject a transplanted organ. So, and now that we have not yet in the world, if we ever will, been able to create a cloned human embryo and derive embryonic stem cells from them, I'm not sure what Eon Wilmot wants to test, but I suspect, and I wrote this, that there may be, again, politics involved here. Because what is happening in the debate over embryonic stem cell research and cloning is that those of us who oppose that research keep pointing out, you know, you can't even try human trials yet. And we're trying to get attention to some of these other sources of research. If Eon Wilmot were able to start doing this human trials, then you'd watch. There'd be big front page news, embryonic stem cell research goes into human testing. And I can predict it here. I'm in Manhattan today. I'm participating in a debate tonight. As sure as the Empire State Building is outside my window, that is what would be said in the media.
Finally, and with only 1 minute, Wesley, I understand that there may be a movie produced about Jack Kevorkian.
Yeah, I drove me crazy because the producer said Jack Kevorkian walks in the footsteps of Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, which means that it would be a lionizing movie. But Jack Kevorkian doesn't deserve to be lionized, even if one agrees with assisted suicide, which I, of course, don't. Jack Kevorkian's motives were never compassionate, and he wrote in Prescription Medicine, what he wanted to do was be able to engage in what he called ovatiatry, that is, human vivisection. His whole purpose in that whole effort he undertook during the 1990s was to be able to experiment on people he was euthanizing for his own ghoulish purposes. And of course, anybody who thinks that's Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King isn't going to tell the truth about Jack Kevorkian.
Folks, to stay informed on the latest bioethical issues, check out www.wesleyjsmith.com. WesleyJSmith.com, it's his website. Wesley Smith is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, special consultant to the Center for Bioethics and Culture, and author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, thanks again for your help on that Bay Area remote on February 19th, and I'm looking forward to seeing you.
I'm looking forward to seeing you again. Maybe this time you'll have a little more hair, huh?
Don't count on it. I'm getting ready to get a haircut tonight. Look, it's like the grass. Got to mow it. Thank you very much, Wesley.
Thanks, Todd.
All right, this is a piece we've had sitting in our audio file for just a day or two. It appeared on NBC, and this is a good thing. I like it when the mainstream press does this kind of thing, where they take us back and just give us not in-depth history, because most of us don't have the attention span for that. That's fine. But at least give us the highlights of where we've been. And the subject of this is the history of the Supreme Court and its nominees on the issue of abortion. Now, you're going to have to listen carefully because it moves kind of fast. But it's going to walk through the nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court on the issue of abortion, what they said in their hearings, and what they eventually, after they got their seats, what they eventually did. One of the things you want to notice here, and this is kind of common knowledge, is the contrast between the position of the president on abortion, who nominates the nominee, and where that Supreme Court justice ends up on the issue of abortion when they're on the Supreme Court. It's a report by Brian Williams from NBC. Here it is.
When Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito returns to Capitol Hill tomorrow, he will face questions about his views on the subject. The landmark case Roe v. Wade, at the center of the debate, was decided 33 years ago this month. Here's NBC's Brian Williams.
It was a momentous week in Washington. A newly re-inaugurated President Nixon announced the end of the war in Vietnam.
All American forces will be withdrawn.
Americans were mourning the loss of former President Lyndon Johnson, and history was made at the Supreme Court.
It handed down a historic decision.
The freedom to have an abortion is now legal in every state.
Roe v. Wade became the law of the land, and the Supreme Court has been an abortion battleground ever since.
I am announcing my choice today.
Gerald Ford nominated John Paul Stevens just 2 years after the abortion case, Over time, Stevens became a dependable vote to uphold Roe versus Wade. Reagan nominee Sandra Day O'Connor took fire from conservatives on abortion, but the president himself came to her defense.
I am completely satisfied.
On her right to life position?
Yes.
O'Connor made known her personal view of abortion.
I am opposed to it.
But as a justice, she reaffirmed a woman's right to choose.
What impact do you think this will have on the abortion issue? Perhaps.
As a nominee, Antonin Scalia voiced moderation on Roe versus Wade.
I assure you, I have no agenda.
As a justice, Scalia voted to overturn it. Another Reagan nominee, Anthony Kennedy, affirmed the very basis of Roe versus Wade.
Liberty includes protection of a value that we call privacy.
When the first President Bush nominated David Souter, abortion was topic A.
You might think the whole nomination had something to do with abortion, and it's far broader than that.
Souter's views on abortion were virtually unknown.
I have not made up my mind.
But as a justice, he has reaffirmed Roe versus Wade, infuriating conservatives to this day.
I wonder in hindsight whether you think the appointment of Justice David Souter then was a mistake. And even
you're trying to get me in trouble with my father, Baker.
There was no litmus test involved.
Abortion was just part of the fight over Clarence Thomas, who, as a nominee, wouldn't talk about it.
I do.
As a justice, Thomas voted to overturn it. Bill Clinton remains the only Democrat since Roe versus Wade to appoint Supreme Court justices. Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer have both supported abortion rights. Now, as George W. Bush shapes the court, abortion remains at center stage.
I'll say it again, there is no litmus test. I think I should stay away from discussions of particular issues that are like...
John Roberts is now Chief Justice Roberts, and it is Samuel Alito's turn to answer questions. Or not. Brian Williams, NBC News, New York.
All right, I want to hear from you on this. I found this very informative. This is the kind of thing you can look up in the history books, and if you search long enough, you'll find it. But contrasting the position of the president who does the nominating with the nominee's position while undergoing the scrutiny of the confirmation process, and where they ended up as a Supreme Court justice on the issue of abortion. Just a brief preview here, and our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Since the time of 1973 Roe v. Wade, we've had John Paul Stevens, Ford nominee, who I didn't catch what his position was during the confirmation hearings, but he became one of the strongest voices in favor of Roe. Reagan appointed Sandra Day O'Connor. She said, they have the quote right there, that she is opposed to abortion during her nomination hearings. She ends up the swing vote, really, on a lot of abortion issues, against things like partial birth abortion, but still willing to uphold Roe. Reagan again. Antonin Scalia. He didn't say what he thought about abortion during his nomination hearings or his confirmation hearings, but he has turned out to be one of the most reliable voices against Roe. In the same way, Bush 1 had two Supreme Court nominees, both Justice Souter and Justice Thomas. One, during his confirmation hearing, said, "I'm undecided." The other one wouldn't give an answer. One turned out to be for Roe. The other one turned out to be against Roe. I think they call that a crapshoot. It's hard to tell. You know, we've talked a lot on the air about how those who are supporting the president's nominee for Supreme Court are doing it partly, maybe to a large part, because there was a promise made of strict constructionists, which, let's just face it, folks, that's code for not finding a right of privacy as the Roe Court did in 1973. Not looking at shadows and implications, but looking at the text of the Constitution, therefore Roe is bad law. I mean, even though people are hesitant to admit it, that's what strict constructionist usually means. It's code for against Roe. Not in each and every case, but in many cases. Now, I don't know if that's what the president means. But you don't know what you're going to get. By every indication, we've got a Chief Justice newly confirmed who is a question mark. and a man sitting in the bullpen headed into the game who has a much longer paper trail on the issue of abortion, but he's not willing to say when pressed on the question. Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to be listening to very lively conversation between David Letterman and Bill O'Reilly. It was Letterman's show. Bill O'Reilly was the guest. Very interesting conversation. We won't play all of it. We're going to play about 5 minutes of it, picking up where the subject turns to Iraq. And I want you to listen for something in the course of this when we come back from this break, hour two of issues, etc. Listen for the contrast between the two types of arguments. Now, you can agree or you can disagree on the issue of the war. That's not the point here. Whether we should be in Iraq, whether we should get out, whether any, you can agree or disagree with both these men on all the issues that are raised. That's not the issue. The issue is listen to the nature of their arguments. It's a good contrast between an objective argument and a subjective argument. And I think you'll be able to hear this in the course of that audio we have for you when we come back from this break. Also, speaking of objective and subjective, coming up at 4:30, Dr. Bart Ehrman will be our guest. He's author of the book, Misquoting Jesus, The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. Many people are shocked to learn that, in particular, the text of the New Testament, also the Old Testament as well, but in particular, the text of the New Testament, has a lot of variations, that the footnotes you find in your English translation are just the tip of the iceberg. Well, Dr. Ehrman says, not just the tip of the iceberg, the New Testament should not be considered a reliable document at all because there's just too many changes and too many variants that people don't know about. We'll talk with him, and I want you to listen again in that conversation and join us afterwards for Open Lines for Subjective and Objective. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is just days away from their annual symposia. One part is on justification in the Scriptures, the other on the person and work of the Holy Spirit. 1 week from today in Fort Wayne, Indiana, you can still find out about it and get ready to go. I urge you to go. Area code 260-452-2247, 260-452-2247, or find out more by going to our homepage, issuesetc.org. Scroll down a little bit and you'll find a link to Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and their annual symposium. It's the 17th through the 20th of this month, well attended by pastors and lay people, and it's worth the trip just for the fellowship. When we come back, very interesting conversation between David Letterman and Bill O'Reilly.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.